It's the Confluence with the News Come Together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. If we sound a little bit different today and in the days ahead, that's because we are doing the show remotely with our reporters, guests, and production staff all operating from different locations. Just like you, we're working from home, social distancing, but we're still with you as the situation evolves. So let's get started. Developments over the last few days have come in fast, from emergency declarations to school closures and more. On the line are reporters Katie Blackley, Ariel Worthy, and Sarah Bowden. Thanks for joining us, folks.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
Usually, we'd all be around one big table together, broadcasting live from Pittsburgh's South Side. That obviously won't do this week. So tell me, everyone, where are you joining me from? Katie, we'll start with you.
I'm in my linen closet on Pittsburgh's North Side.
Ariel, what about you?
I have built a pillow fort in my guest bedroom.
Anything to make that sound better than it would be, right?
Yeah, anything.
And Sarah Bowden, what about you?
I am also surrounded by pillows in my bedroom.
Okay. So the number of positive cases in Pennsylvania continue to climb. Businesses, government, others have shut down non-essential operations. Ariel, for government, what does that mean? What is essential?
So essential is basically your police officers, firefighters, your garbage collectors, those people, that is still in operation. You will still get your trash collected if you call 911. They will still come if it is, especially if it's a violent emergency or an injury. Things like police reports and all that, they're actually trying to cut down on having officers come to those. And they actually have a line where you can call and get file a police report and do that remotely, basically.
Mm-hmm. And what about the non-essential workers? Are they still working? Are they working remotely?
Many of them are working from home. City Council, they actually are considered essential, but they are going to have their weekly City Council meetings remotely. So all the council members will actually be calling. And if you want to leave a comment, like if the public wants to leave a comment, they actually can email, or they can do it the old-fashioned way and do snail mail. But the counselors themselves, with the exception of the council president, Teresa Kale Smith, and the city clerk, they will be the only ones in chambers.
You mentioned people could do comments because Tuesday and Wednesday, normal days for meetings of city council, and people are used to being able to make comments before the sessions get underway. And so they can email those comments in instead of being able to go up in front of the microphone for 3 minutes, correct?
Correct, yeah. They said just email them to the city clerk. Or, you know, like I said, if you want to, you know, get a stamp and write them a letter, you can also do that. It might get there a little late, but, you know, that is an option.
Ariel, you mentioned police, firefighters, paramedics, trash being collected. Have individuals, have officials giving any indication that working from home, the other workers, might affect citizens at all and what they expect from their city?
The city itself, they kept trying to say, you know, it's going to be business as usual. They really kind of want things to remain as normal as possible. But, you know, if you go to the city county building, it's going to be pretty much empty. You know, so there might be certain things that you might not be able to get done that you would usually get done just because people will be working from home. But they are trying to make it as normal as possible under these circumstances.
Katie, what about businesses? You spoke with one small business owner in the park yesterday. That was just before Governor Tom Wolf extended his mandate that all non-essential businesses close. What were you hearing?
Yeah, I went down to Allegheny Commons Monday morning, and I met a couple who actually own a dog grooming business on the north side. And they were walking their dogs, and we were just kind of discussing how bizarre this entire situation is. And as small business owners, at that point, they had not been asked to close. They are non-essential, technically. You don't need to take your dog to be groomed, although it's nice if you're quarantined with it, I suppose. But they were kind of mulling over whether to close because they don't have a lot of human contact. You know, it's mostly dogs. But I imagine, you know, after Monday's announcement that they probably will close.
And the parks themselves, they are open, not just to organized groups. That's a good thing, I guess.
They are very much open. And the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy is encouraging people to take advantage of the city's something like 165 parks and parklets. I spoke with Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy CEO Jane Miller on Monday afternoon, and she told me they actually saw an uptick in social media mentions over the weekend of people, you know, tagging that they were at Shenley Park hanging out with their family or they were taking a hike in Riverview Park. And she said, you know, this is a great time to reconnect with nature. And I know that sounds kind of cheesy, but there really are research-backed up benefits of being outside. It lowers your blood pressure. It makes you just feel better. And so for people feeling anxiety right now, I can really see that being a solution.
Well, feeling better brings us to WESA's health reporter, Sarah Bowden. Sarah, the State Department of Health decided Monday that they'd be dropping some terminology. No more presumed or even confirmed cases, only positive ones. Why the change?
That's right. Now, if you test positive, you test positive. Basically, the Pennsylvania Department of Health is no longer to send, is no longer required to send positive samples to the CDC or Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for confirmation. But we've known that when somebody tests positive at the state lab, they're certainly positive. So there wasn't concern about the quality of testing at the state lab. Also, commercial labs, which are now coming online now, are also not required to get confirmation from the CDC. So I think this just kind of helps. This is kind of a sign that more and more entities are doing testing and the CDC is recognizing that.
So as soon as a positive came about, they weren't waiting for the CDC to confirm the necessary precautions were already in place at that point.
That's right. In fact, even before test results came back, if somebody was showing symptoms or possibly was exposed to coronavirus, they were told to self-quarantine or isolate. And then certainly once the test result came back from the state, you were definitely not supposed to be around anybody else.
Sarah, you mentioned about more commercial testers. Do we have a sense of how this might pick up the process? More testing more quickly? Do we have any idea at this point as more testing comes on board?
Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully, maybe in the tens of thousands of tests we can start seeing. The fact of the matter is the U.S. is very much behind other countries like South Korea when it comes to testing, and that puts us at a distinct disadvantage when it comes to staying healthy and staying ahead of the spread of the coronavirus. I don't know if it's going to be enough, but more places are coming online, including UPMC, which said that by the end of this week, hopefully they'll be able to test as many as 100 samples a day.
Okay. So businesses are shutting down operations. Our colleague, Margaret J. Krause, reports that workers affected by coronavirus may be eligible for unemployment benefits if their employer has closed or gone out of business because of the response to the virus, or if they've lost hours or been told to actually isolate due to possible exposure. How hard is it for a small business, for just a regular person right now, to lay low for a week, 2 weeks, maybe even more? Katie?
That's the question, isn't it? These businesses are small, like you said, and a lot of the workers there rely on tips and they rely on the wages that they get from going to work each day. They're not salaried people. So many of them don't have paid sick leave, and that is a problem. And I think that's something that's really being highlighted right now is just these gaps in worker compensation. And also, I think, you know, the story that Margaret did about unemployment benefits is a really good step. But from what I heard from people who are in the service industry, they're really concerned that it's going to take a long time. There's going to be such an influx of people applying. When will they see those benefits? Because their bills aren't going away. Their rent isn't going away. But their jobs are temporarily.
Right. And the Department of Labor and Industry indicated that, yes, it's the normal application process. And I believe the earliest you could see a check is 4 weeks. Monday was the first day of mandatory school closings. Katie, you and education reporter Sarah Schneider have been keeping an eye on how different school districts are responding. What have you learned? I know the Pittsburgh Public Schools has an emergency plan in place, but we're talking about 100 school districts in our listening area alone.
Yes, there are 1.7 million kids in Pennsylvania. So you can imagine this is disrupting lives all throughout the Commonwealth. In Pittsburgh, they are providing instructional packets for students to take online. They have a portal that students can access. And they're also providing meals, kind of to-go, grab-and-go meals at schools. And students can pick up those meals at the school closest to them. So it might not necessarily be the school that they attend, but the school that is closest to them, hypothetically, that they can get to quickly. They're open, I believe, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. for lunchtime, and I think they also have breakfast available.
We're looking at the impact of the spread of the coronavirus in the Pittsburgh region with WESA reporters Sarah Bowden, Ariel Worthy, and Katie Blackley. Sarah, a lot of people might hear this and think, well, I'm not medically compromised. I'm good to go outside. Why are health officials arguing against that mentality?
Because you can still spread germs, and you can spread germs to people who are medically compromised, who are over 60, which is not that old. And these are the groups of people that are particularly vulnerable to COVID-19. And so unless you want to be responsible for somebody dying, you should stay away from other people.
But the supermarkets, those kind of things are still open, so people are still going for food.
Of course, those are essential businesses. So essential businesses, supermarkets, pharmacies, gas stations, those are open. Now bars are closed across the state, but up until very recently, a lot of people were at bars and they were sharing germs. And I'm very curious to know how COVID-19 cases might be spiking as a result of this, you know, maybe weekend celebrations or whatever. It's I'm very concerned.
Mm-hmm. If you do leave your house, a note if you are traveling by car on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, no cash or credit cards are being accepted. If you don't have an easy pass, a camera will take a photo of your license plate and you will be billed. So, Ariel, what about our elected leaders? Did the mayor or county executive give any indication that additional, more drastic steps are being considered?
Yeah, so originally the city actually said that events of 250 people or more would be prohibited, but now the number is actually down to 50 for the city, so groups of no more than 50 people, but the county says no more than 20 people should congregate. So those numbers are really dwindling. They're really just emphasizing for everyone to stay away from each other, basically, just really practice that social distancing. And the county also emphasized on Saturday when they announced the first cases that, you know, if you don't have a primary care physician and that you feel like you need to get tested, call the health department and they will get you tested through the state.
And President Trump on Monday also recommended that groups be limited to 10 or fewer. That was just a recommendation.
Yeah.
So what can we expect from all of you going forward? What stories are you planning to pursue as this outbreak continues to be a part of our lives? Ariel, what are you keeping your eye on?
Well, the city seems to be breaking news every day when it comes to the coronavirus, so I'm just kind of keeping up with them and seeing what they're breaking. And, just following it that way.
Katie, you've been covering a lot of different aspects of the spread of the coronavirus. What are you keeping your eye on?
Well, as usual at the newsroom, they'll put me where they need me, so we'll see if I do any more reporting like that. But I do want to recommend people check out our live blog that we've been doing on a weekly. We do one each week, and so this week's just began on Monday. And we update it, I mean, very, very often because, like Ariel said, the news changes quickly. So it's right on the front of the website, and that's where you can find me.
And Sarah Bowden, from a health perspective, what are you looking for? What are some of the answers that you want to hear?
definitely going to keep an eye on how much testing is available. If you want to hear a really good story about testing, check out my editor Liz Reed's story that she had on Friday. It really gives a nice overview about what we don't know about who's getting tested. Also, as everybody is aware, we've really shut down everything here in Pennsylvania, and that's to emphasize social distancing, to encourage people to stay away from each other. In about 2 weeks, we're going to see if it works. So, you know, stay tuned.
See if that line has flattened out at all?
Yeah, hopefully we're going to flatten that curve. We're going to find out in 2 weeks. Everyone can do their part, of course, by staying away from each other.
Reporters Sarah Bowden, Katie Blackley, and Ariel Worthy are part of the WESA news team covering the impact of coronavirus on our region and its residents. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find the latest information on our coronavirus live blog at our website, WESA.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. There could be a lot of harmful bacteria in residential water wells across the state. Plus, a conversation about who the real power players are in Pennsylvania. And Pittsburgh's new sick leave ordinance might seem to have arrived at just the right time, but we'll hear about how it could have helped more if it had been in place sooner. Do you have a story or perspective worth sharing about living in Pittsburgh during the COVID-19 outbreak? Send your suggestions to confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website, at wesa.fm/confluence.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Bethany Cosentino from the band Best Coast. Cosentino grew up in the musically rich landscape of Southern California. Her father, Ricky Cosentino, is a well-known studio musician, and Bethany got into the music and acting worlds at a young age. In 2009, she formed Best Coast with multi-instrumentalist Bob Bruno, channeling modern power pop and retro girl group sounds into songs about boys, cats, and California sunshine. Cosentino also sings about heavier topics like depression and sobriety. Outspoken and open with her fans, Cosentino is a musical role model, unafraid to tackle any topic in her songs. A playlist with music from all of WYEP's Women's History Month artists is at WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In recent voluntary testing conducted by LNP Newspaper and Lancaster Online, almost 2 out of 3 residential water wells sampled in Lancaster County contain potentially harmful bacteria. WITF's Brett Schultes partnered with LNP to learn what the testing found and the risks of drinking tainted water.
This is the well head right here with the casing.
Bob and Shirley Redkay are standing next to the water well outside their home in Denver, Lancaster County.
Well, there's a pipe sticking out of the ground. It looks like it's about 8 inches around.
That pipe goes 200 feet into the ground, where a pump draws out the water that the Redkays drink and cook with every day.
And then it has a silver lid to it that is bolted on.
It's pretty cold out, so we head inside where Bob recounts having the house built almost 4 years ago after he and Shirley moved to Lancaster County from Florida.
You know, we decided we liked the view. It was a nice mountain view, and we went from there.
What Bob and Shirley didn't know was that, unlike in Florida, there's no requirement to test water wells at homes in Pennsylvania. After realizing nobody from the county or state was coming to certify their well as safe to use, they paid a private contractor to have a test done.
Well, this is the first water report that we got.
Shirley opens a folder and pulls out the results from that test, which looked for coliform bacteria. Those organisms aren't necessarily harmful, but they signal that disease-causing pathogens such as E. coli could be present.
And when it came back, it said that there was coliform bacteria, but it didn't say how much. It didn't say if there was E. coli or not. And it recommended that we do not drink or cook with the water. And that was kind of scary But we had been drinking and cooking with it for years without any problems. So it's like, what do we do now?
Shirley says the test results left them more confused and worried than they were before they got it tested.
There's nothing being done to alert you if you have E. coli in the water. It's up to you to figure that out.
The Red K's volunteered to have LNP test their water, and it came back positive for a fairly low concentration of coliform bacteria and was negative for the dangerous E. coli bacteria.
So all in all, the test looks pretty good, but it is something to be mindful of, just because you do have the potential path for it getting worse.
Compared to some other homes in Lancaster County, the Red K's were lucky.
So you've had it tested twice, and both times they were fine? Like
both times, no problems, yeah.
Okay.
So
LNP reporter Harubi Mako was part of the effort to sample the water. She notes seven samples did test positive for E. coli, including another home in Denver that had a very high concentration. LNP also tested for nitrates, which typically come from fertilizers and manure. She says 17 homes had levels of nitrates that would have been considered unacceptable if it was a public water system.
So this household had more than two times the allotted safe drinking water levels.
Mako says the solutions for this problem are well known. Groups like the Pennsylvania Groundwater Association have long pushed for regulations requiring that wells are grouted and sealed to keep contaminants out. As recently as 5 years ago, lawmakers introduced a bill to require that wells are built to certain standards.
It seems like the lawmakers got bombarded with people saying, like, do not regulate my well. Like, leave my private water alone. It's mine.
Rewind back a couple weeks, and Harubi and I drove a few miles north of Harrisburg to meet with Jennifer Fetter, whose job is to educate the public about water issues.
There's only about 14 million private wells in the entire country, so we have a big portion of them here in Pennsylvania.
Fetter says many people are surprised to learn that over a million households in Pennsylvania are served by private wells. She says Pennsylvania and Alaska are the only states that don't regulate the construction of wells or require water testing.
So those million households are at risk of having drinking water contaminants that folks on public water supplies are not at risk of having.
Those private wells are scattered all over Pennsylvania.
Like Bucks and Montgomery County have tons, Chester County, tons of private water supplies. Here in Dauphin County, we have lots of private water supplies.
Fetter says most contaminants are produced by agriculture or other man-made activities.
Every time we drill another hole into the ground, every time we create another well, we create another superhighway down into our aquifers.
Neighborhoods with lots of new wells, like the Red K's neighborhood, can make groundwater vulnerable to pollutants on the surface. As a result, infants, children, and other sensitive groups could be at risk for a host of health problems that come from consuming bacteria and nitrates. In fact, those nitrates can cause so-called blue baby syndrome, where babies are unable to get enough oxygen.
And that's why they call it blue baby syndrome, because you actually start to see the mucous membranes and things turning blue from the deprivation of oxygen. And if it reaches a certain level, obviously it's like suffocation. Even though they're breathing, the oxygen's not being transported in the blood to the body tissues. So that can be a really serious health problem that's caused directly by nitrates.
Well, what I think is ironic.
Back at the Red K's home in Denver, Shirley says she thinks a lot about vulnerable groups like infants and children.
And the elderly, I guess we qualify.
And she says it's been surprising to learn there are no regulations.
In the past, we've donated money to other countries to help people get safe drinking water, and having no clue that there was the potential for us to be the ones with the unsafe drinking water.
The Red K's say they're taking measures to purify their water. They're considering installing a filtering system that can cost thousands of dollars, and they plan to keep having their water tested. As they discovered, living in Pennsylvania with a private water well, the responsibility is on them to make sure their drinking water is safe. In Denver, Lancaster County, I'm Brett Schultes.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In Harrisburg, a few names get the glory, but many more get things done. Reporter Mike Warshagen and his colleagues at the Caucus newspaper in Harrisburg are shining a light on some of our state's greatest power players. Mike, welcome back to The Confluence.
Always a pleasure, Kevin.
You break these folks down into three categories, so we'll do the same. Movers and shakers, rising stars, and the most powerful. Nearly all the movers and shakers are not elected officials, not accountable to voters. So who do they represent?
Well, we're seeing a lot of grassroots mobilization over the last few years. So, for instance, Carol Cunahome of Fair Districts, Pennsylvania, her group was created to make redistricting more of a kind of front of the mind issue. Mm-hmm. And she has, in many, many ways, she and the rest of the people at Fair Districts have succeeded. It's gone from this kind of obscure topic that nobody really talked about to something that really was a factor in the last couple of elections because people realize how important these districts are. Another one is Dana Brown right here at Chatham University. Right. She created the Ready to Run program to
which has encouraged and sparked a lot of women candidates through the years.
Right. And that's something important to keep in mind. When you see these election results like we had in the 2018 midterms, where it's you have all of these women who are suddenly coming into office and it's sort of a sea change. That didn't happen by itself. It happened because people like Dr. Brown were sort of helping build that infrastructure for women candidates to enter what is a male-dominated field.
So as the director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham, she's shaking things up in state government, would you say?
In state politics, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not just state government. It's also federal government. Mm-hmm. One of the graduates of her Ready to Run program is Representative Chrissy Houlihan. Who is now in the U.S. Congress.
Pennsylvania has long had a poor record of the number of women in the legislature. Any inroads expected this year?
That depends. It's almost as if politics in this state is sort of trying to find its level. People are realizing that Harrisburg is still dominated by men, but that is changing. The culture in Harrisburg is changing. The composition of the legislature is changing. And so I don't think that's a trend that's going to start going the other way anytime soon.
So the couple that you mentioned in the movers and shakers really have, in a sense, an agenda, whether it is fair districts mm-hmm. or getting more women involved in the electoral process. Are there also still the ones we tend to think of, the lobbyists in terms of businesses and the like?
Oh, certainly. Some of the folks on the list include Ray Zaborni and Mike Long. These are two people who run two different lobbying firms. Ray Zaborni runs Red Maverick, which is sort of a suite of three different companies. And then you have Mike Long, who is a founding partner of Long Nyquist. These are both very well-connected, very powerful lobbying firms that are interesting because they don't just lobby. They also run campaigns. So you have one end of this, one end of their organization that is helping get people elected. The other end of the organization is lobbying those same people once they get them elected.
Investigative reporter Mike Wershagen is our guest. He and his colleagues at the caucus have profiled key players in state government. The list of the most powerful includes the governor, House and Senate leaders. No surprise there. Are they listed in order of the most powerful? Because Attorney General Josh Shapiro is at the top of that list.
Well, not necessarily, but Governor Wolf is in his last term. Josh Shapiro is running for re-election as Attorney General, which is an enormously powerful office, a very high-profile office. And though he is not one to come out and say it, it's out there that this is not the end point for him, that he has his eyes on higher office.
And so, that could happen 2 years from now.
Could happen 2 years from now when Governor Wolf leaves. Now, Josh Shapiro, Attorney General Shapiro, has said repeatedly, look, I'm just running for this office. I'm not talking about the next thing. And, you know, 2 years is a long time, and so I wouldn't be surprised if he actually hadn't made up his mind. But that is right. Out there. That's a big vacancy, and he's in a big seat.
Two of the politicians on the most powerful list, House Speaker Terzine, Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati, are not seeking re-election. So a year from now, this list, it's going to look a bit different, I guess.
It certainly is. Those are the top two Republicans in the state legislature. The House Speaker and the Senate President Pro Tem are both enormously powerful positions. They're also very high-profile positions, which allows these two to be major, major fundraisers for their party. And so when they step down, there's going to be a power vacuum and there's going to be a fundraising vacuum. And somebody's going to have to step up and fill those shoes.
And then a group that isn't elected, the Pennsylvania State Education Association, they're the state's largest union. Is that enough to make them that powerful?
Yes, it is. They are able to mobilize individuals, mobilize, you know, a large group of people. They're also able to raise an enormous amount of money. Back when Governor Corbett took office, there was a big to-do about education cuts, right? Corbett said, I'm not cutting education. I'm just not backfilling the stimulus funding when it runs out. Right. But by the time he came out and said that, PSEA had been out there banging this drum. And so the narrative was set. The Corbett cuts were known as the Corbett cuts from then on.
Mike, among the rising stars, give us a name who's climbing but is still not that well known. And why are they rising?
Well, we have several. I'd probably start with Senator Lisa Baker.
Chair of the Judiciary Committee.
That's correct.
And a Republican.
Those two things are why I would put her kind of high up on that list. It's because she is in the majority party in the Senate, and her committee, the Judiciary Committee, is one of the weightier committees in Harrisburg, right? The crime bills, gun legislation, all of these big, meaty issues come in front of her committee. And at the same time, you've got criminal justice reform becoming a major, you know, issue in a lot of different circles. So, and not just Democratic circles anymore. We're seeing movement on the Republican side too. And so she is in a really, really interesting position.
Senator Baker, recent guest on the Confluence. Give us another one that you're keeping an eye on as a rising star.
Senator Muth is
Katie Muth.
She came to Harrisburg ready to break stuff.
What does she call the Capitol? The Dome of Corruption?
The Dome of Corruption. Yeah, she has not been quiet once she got there. So she hasn't really absorbed the Harrisburg culture in the way that you see a lot of, you know, sort of rank and file politicians do. They all sort of fall into line. She's not doing that.
Katie Muth, also a recent guest on the Confluence. She's not one to be silenced.
No, she is not.
Especially when she's speaking for victims' rights.
For victims' rights, and also sort of more generally the culture in Harrisburg. I mean, I think she is the anger you hear is genuine. We've heard people talk about this a lot, about how it is this old boys club. Yeah, she's now on the inside, and she's not backing off of that idea, of those ideals that she had when she showed up.
Mike, anyone on the list, or even in your mental Rolodex, that you think could have an outsized influence on the 2020 primary or even the general election in November?
I'd keep an eye on John Fetterman.
Why?
Because John Fetterman just finished a 67-county listening tour for marijuana legalization, right? And that means there are people in every corner of the state that have seen this guy, that have heard him speak. And, you know, back in 2016, the Clinton campaign got some advice from former Governor Ed Rendell, right? Governor Rendell had spoken to John Fetterman. He'd been watching Fetterman's rise. He got in touch with the Clinton campaign and said, listen, instead of dumping another few million dollars into whatever your next ad is going to be, an ad that we've all seen 10 times, put John Fetterman in a truck, give him a driver, send him out there, because Fetterman can walk into places that Hillary Clinton can't. He can talk to people Hillary Clinton can't talk to, that just won't listen to her.
And did they take the advice?
They did not. And Hillary Clinton became the first Democrat to lose Pennsylvania since 1988. My guess is the next Democratic nominee is going to think long and hard before rejecting that.
Mike Warshagen is an investigative reporter for the caucus, which has profiled the well-known and not-so-well-known people who are running Pennsylvania's Capitol. Thanks, Mike.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. The city's new paid sick leave ordinance took effect this weekend, and on first glance, it seems like the policy arrived just in time. Like everyone else across the nation, Pittsburghers are social distancing, working from home, and taking advantage of whatever sick time they can to avoid, and potentially for some, likely recover from COVID-19. Unfortunately, WESA reporter Maria Rose finds that the policy probably won't reduce the spread as effectively as it might have had it commenced sooner. Maria, thanks so much for joining us on this work-from-home friendly edition of The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with why. Why won't it help more employees right away?
So basically, the city ordinance that was implemented on Sunday gives workers 1 hour of sick leave for every 35 hours that they work. But unfortunately, because it started on Sunday, the accrual period for those 35 hours is started then. So basically, workers will have to go in over the next couple of days in order to build up that time to take off an hour or however long they need to take off.
So if that clock started just on Sunday, when are employees expected to get their first earned day off? It doesn't sound like it's anytime soon.
Not soon. And I think what's more is that the way the ordinance is written is that people can only start taking their days off 90 days into the actual ordinance. So 3 months from now is when people would technically, according to the ordinance, be able to start staying home on paid sick leave.
How important is paid sick time? You know, we're living in the time of COVID-19 right now, but more generally, why is it an important part of a benefits package, for example?
Yeah, so I spoke with Dr. Stephen Albert at the University of Pittsburgh, who works with infectious disease, and he was saying that about 12% of flu transmissions occur in the workplace, and about 3/4 of those transmissions are when people come into work already feeling sick. So it's important to be able to stay home when people are sick to avoid transmission. And part of the reason that people don't is when they feel the economic burden and pressure of needing to go into work to keep their jobs, to make money. And so people take that risk in order to be able to pay the bills.
And so I guess he posits then that paid sick time would cut the rate of flu transmission.
Yeah. So even if the rate of transmission decreases and it seems like it's not that much, Dr. Albert says that if about 12% of flu transmissions occur at work, that number is cut basically in half. And even if that doesn't sound like a lot, the number of people who are actually infected decreases a lot.
You would cut maybe 3,500 to 4,000 infections per season in Allegheny County. That's not a trivial number.
Another thing I'll add into that is the ordinance cites that within Pittsburgh, 40% of the private sector and 77% of service workers in the city lack access to paid sick time. So when we see that number reflected in the workforce here, that's a lot of people who are now able to stay home and recover as they need to.
And that's just for bigger employers, right? You report that firms with less than 15 workers, they only get unpaid time for their first year. Does that then reduce their incentive to take their earned time at all if it's all unpaid?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure how that's going to play out number-wise when we see it. But I was talking with Dr. Albert, and he was saying that policies like this, paid sick time, will be more effective the smaller an organization is, because typically smaller organizations are the ones that don't have sick leave policies in place. Bigger ones often will have something already kind of established within their organization. And so those organizations don't even need to necessarily follow this if they have something greater than the 35 hours work to 1 hour off policy. But smaller organizations are the ones who actually need to be able to take time off. And if it's unpaid time, I'm not sure how much people will feel like they can skip that work if they're still not making money anyways.
So whether they're big or small, do companies have the option to just give workers time off up front?
I think that's hard. Being able to front load sick time off, some organizations have kind of a rainy day fund to be able to do that and others don't. But what's important to remember, I think, is that the economic impact of this can be measured way long term and also short term. So short term, even if people are kind of taking a hit, having to pay overtime, or having to maybe hire more workers, in the long term, it will reduce turnover, being able to follow sick leave policies. It'll maintain health. And Dr. Albert finds that it boosts morale. And so if workers feel like they can commit to an organization because they're enabled to take time off, long term, it's going to have a better economic impact.
Well, and looking at those economics, this policy, I want to clarify, is it for people who live in Pittsburgh or people who work in Pittsburgh?
So anybody who has work that happens in Pittsburgh, like even if their headquarters or employer isn't in the city, they still get it. So somebody who's like a truck driver could come. But another thing, too, is like independent contractors can't have it and seasonal workers don't get this. Policies like this, they just need to be kind of in place. Infections don't follow like municipal boundaries, right? So even if Pittsburgh has it, it's not necessarily going to impact people if they're living in the county or like kind of working between different places or going in and out of the city line.
Maria Rose reports for WESA. Maria, thanks so much for your work.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. A reminder to keep up to date on how the spread of the new coronavirus is affecting our region, our state, and our neighbors, please go to our coronavirus blog, that is updated throughout the day at WESA.FM. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.